This is CNT Talk. Every week, two friends debate the issues of the ages as we agree to disagree. It's never politically correct, but it's always entertaining. Join us tonight so you can sound knowledgeable at work tomorrow. We're smacking you upside the head with the hammer of truth. Welcome to the show. Hello, hello, and welcome to the show. Tony, we have a voicemail. I'd like to play the voicemail. I'd like to get your reactions to the voicemail. He named you specifically.
Oh.
So, in a good way.
Oh, that's okay.
So, it's a positive thing. One of our longtime listeners also has a podcast, Eric. I'm going to play his voicemail, let it play out through, because he's complimentary about us, and I want to react to some of the things he does say.
See, Chad, you're just cherry-picking complimentary voicemails.
No. There's some... he's not real happy at the end, but...
Okay, good.
Okay, here we go.
Good evening, gentlemen. It's Eric from Talk Back. I am a little behind on your podcast. I apologize, but I just listened to Steel City Nightmare and wanted to commend you on a fantastic episode. I thought your points related to the gun violence and the taking away of guns and all the talk related to that was spot on. I found Tony's comedic representation of all that includes was fantastic, as well as the North Korean situation and this notion that, the left is more after Donald Trump than they are after North Korea. I actually agree with you on that. I think it's disgusting, and I think it's, although you know me as not a Trump supporter, someone who didn't vote for Trump, we do, in fact, live in the Trump presidency, and that's the result of the election, and I'm all in favor of that and this media circus related to just finding any way possible to impeach him or remove him from office, I think is just disgusting. And I'm all with you on all of those points. So I think you guys represented that all very well. My question to you is, I'm actually not a Fox News supporter. I'm not a CNN supporter. I really hate most media these days, because I think they're all agenda-driven, and I think you guys have said that before, too. No matter which channel you turn to, you're either going to find a Trump roasting or a Trump defense. My issue is, how do we get someone like a Tony into national presence where a rational, reasonable defense against the left is put out there? I think people just don't really listen to Fox much anymore unless they're entrenched on the right, because Fox irritates people just as much as CNN irritates people. People get tired of, well, Trump, anything he does is, you know, perfect. And I appreciate that lately, over the past month or two, you guys, I feel, have been very fair, calling out Trump on the stupid, idiotic things he does or says, versus also, you know, laying out there that from a policy position, the world really isn't worse off right now, and he's following through on a lot of campaign promises. But the question is, how do we get that voice out there? Because I think that's where we're struggling. Now, the end of your show kind of ruined it for me. I'm a big LeBron James apologist, but I would recommend you listen to episode 142 of Talk Back. I got to plug myself a little bit. I agree with you a lot more than you might think about LeBron James and his leftist policy views. I'm not in support of all of that, but I wasn't real happy with the Laura Ingram angle and that whole thing. But listen to episode 142 or bring me in for longer than a 1 minute period on a voicemail and we can go over that. But anyway, Steel City Nightmare, great episode. Enjoying what you guys do lately. Appreciate all the truth and honesty out there, and keep it going, man. Thanks. Talk to you soon.
See, now, we did give him more than a minute.
We gave him over 3 minutes,
right.
So we're very fair and
actually,
balanced that way.
Now, my wife would say it's incredibly scary that Eric would think that I should be in a position of...
I was thinking the same thing.
The conservative position. So it's flattering that he says that. I have a feeling that if I had a national platform, the pitchfork-wielding mobs would be descending upon us. I guess a couple of things. I hadn't heard that voice.
That's first. I listened to it once other time, just that second time I've listened to it. So.
Two things that he raised there. I guess maybe I'll talk about the LeBron issue just very briefly.
We'll talk about that at the end.
Oh, you want to hold that to the end?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So that's his criticism. So, Eric, when you listen to this, listen to the end, because we'll talk about LeBron at the end about that. So go ahead with
the rest
of it.
So then the other issue that he had, this idea of, you know, how do we get whatever you want to call it, truthful, sane, effective policy voices out there. Well, first of all, I actually do think there's a lot of very articulate, effective people who, you know, espouse sort of a conservative worldview from a political perspective. There's people that also are Christians, which, you know, we're Christians first.
Mm-hmm.
Politics is completely sort of irrelevant in many ways to, you know, our faith. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people who happen to be conservatives who are also very devout and outspoken and highly intelligent and persuasive Christians who are out there. Now, do those people occupy the heights of the popular culture? Probably not.
No.
And I do think Eric makes a good point that one of my frustrations frequently in taking in any sort of media where there are policy debates is that many, many of the talking heads are just they're not good. They're not particularly knowledgeable. Not all of them, and I could go through a list of people. You know, someone like a Ben Shapiro, mm-hmm. very, very smart guy.
Yes,
very effective.
Talks faster than you. He
does talk faster than me, which is kind of amazing. But for the most part, you know what you see on these late night crossfire kind of segments.
Well, isn't that it's designed that way?
Right,
isn't
it's designed for shouting and acrimony and. But it really doesn't help people understand the issues. And look, I agree. I'm not really a Fox News watcher.
I'm not a Fox News watcher. I'm not a CNN watcher. I read. I watch clips of different things because I want to see it. But he says, how do we get this out there? I don't think in today's media market you can, simply because they are designed to be shotgun at each other and arguing. And if you go to Fox News, you're probably going to get Trump apologists. And if you go to CNN, you're going to get Trump haters.
And the media,
that's
kind
of how it works.
And the media is, I'll use as an example, we talked about this last week, that CNN embarrassment, that whole circus revolving gun, that mm-hmm. was not designed to do anything other than have a group of people scream at another group of people. That was it. We're going to have the villains, the black-hatted NRA supporters, and we're going to have a like-minded audience and a bunch of demagogues on stage that are going to just yell at them and call them murderers. So the media is not interested in many ways in having any sort of meaningful, civil, informed, substantive discussion about these issues. Number one, because most of the media are partisans. They're, you know, as Glenn Reynolds would say, they are Democrats with bylines. But number two, in terms of ratings and what they're going after, they don't want any sort of detailed, informed policy debate. Mm-hmm. They just want a bunch of people yelling.
Oh, that's what, to this point, that's what people watch. If you want to watch those shows, that's what you come in for, because in reality, every one of those networks, that's basically what they have. They have their token opposite of everybody else on the stage, and they blast that person, say, you're awful. Look at The View. They get one conservative and four or five liberals who just blast the conservative. Well, how could you possibly think that? It doesn't matter what the show is. That's the format. So how do we get somebody out there? You get Ben Shapiro. You get somebody like Ben Shapiro to have more of a presence.
Right,
but I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
He's never going to have a media platform that really allows him to do that. And I think this point has been made by a number of people. The social media culture, I think, has exacerbated the existing sort of cultural divisions that we have, the partisan divisions, because social media just allows people to aggregate in their little groups, mm-hmm. you know, their monocultures, their echo chambers, and then to scream, you know, to tweet nasty things at other people. And it's the same thing with Facebook. And so I think social media has largely made things far worse in terms of public debate, in terms of complete lack of decorum, mm-hmm. complete lack of any sort of respect. And I think it's a huge problem for the country. I really do. I don't, you know, people say these things all the time. And a lot of people, if you know this, if you would go back and read some of the things that were said in newspapers, okay, back before the turn of the century, okay, in the 19th century.
Yellow journalism, yes.
What the stuff that they would say is unbelievable. So this has always existed, right? This level of sort of acrimony and scurrilous charges, yellow journalism, all of that. But it's now amplified because everyone has their own little megaphone,
right?
Meaning their computer,
right,
and their Facebook page, or and podcast, their Twitter feed, and their yes, and their podcast, and it's just a bunch of people that are growing to sort of hate each other, mm-hmm, because we differ on politics.
Well, I think you can hide. You have the anonymity of social media, that you can say things like, you can create a Twitter account. I know you wouldn't know this, but you can create a Twitter account saying any name you want, not being really verified that it's even you, just saying whatever you feel like. Now, they might trace it back to you eventually, but people can do that over and over and over. And you bring up the 19th century. Even in the 18th century, the politicians were sniping each other under pseudonyms, trying to get whatever they wanted across, and they had partisan papers at that point. I think it's gotten worse because you have more of a forum. There's more places to do this, but I don't think it has ever been different than this. I think this is always, but it was. You just have more opportunity to see it. And I don't think the mainstream media is ever going to give somebody a fair imbalance. They don't want fair imbalance. They want partisan because they're led by people who are partisan. That's what they want, whether it's Fox News versus CNN. CNN is led by groups of people who want a certain agenda to come out. ESPN, which shouldn't just be about sports, as we've talked about many times. It should be about sports, but it really isn't. It's how sports and politics intersect. Laura Ingraham reacting to an ESPN piece about LeBron James and Kevin Durant. It's weird to think about that, but that's what it is. So I think in answer to Eric's question, I don't think you can get a fair amount because people don't want fair amounts. They want their echo chamber. Until people don't want an echo chamber, which may never happen, I don't think you can get away from that.
No, and I also think that with the growing influence of the left, meaning, again, we've talked about this many times, that there's a critique that the Republican Party, okay, and I'm a conservative, okay, I'm a Republican because
there's no conservative party.
Right, has been the political vessel for conservatism, and we can have a long argument about whether that continues to be true with the presidency of Donald Trump, mm-hmm, who has never been a conservative, who has never really been anyone who has any fixed political moorings. But my point is that the critique is usually, oh, the conservatives have gone off the rails. They're now an extremist party. I would argue that it is much more true that the Democratic Party has become almost a completely progressive party. Mm-hmm. There really is no place in the Democratic Party these days for what I would consider to be a traditional liberal. Okay,
not a nationally traditional liberal, I believe.
Right, historically, traditional liberal.
Yeah, I think you get some local, hyper-local representatives could still be liberal and still get elected.
Yes, that's true.
At a national level, I agree with you.
Because I draw a very, very clear distinction between someone who's a progressive, that's essentially a leftist, mm-hmm, and someone who is a classical, traditional liberal, who actually believes in liberalism, which favors things like free speech, all the things that leftists hate, mm-hmm, and try to stamp out. And my point is that we now have a political party in this country that has a view of America that is almost alienated from the country as it was founded in terms of its ideals. That was never true, or hadn't been true maybe until the 60s, right?
Yeah.
There was a general consensus about the American experiment. Okay, now there was obviously political disagreements about means and methods and policies, but I don't know how you bridge a divide between one side of the country that fundamentally believes in the Constitution, believes in the vision of the founders. And again, we could talk about what is that? Is it a Christian country? No, that's not what I'm talking about. But I am talking about at least the notion that America, for all of its flaws and its many, many ills, lump in racism, lump in all of the things that go with any society, America was fundamentally a good country that has been a net positive in the world. Leftists do not believe that about this country at all.
Do you think they ever did?
No, they don't.
Because they're leftists.
Of course they don't.
Right.
I mean, their view is that America is, pick your ism, mm-hmm, an imperialist, colonialist, racist, oppressive, go down the litany of epithets that needs to be fundamentally transformed. Where have you heard that before, Chad? Into a different place.
Hope and change.
I don't think that you can really bridge a divide when you're talking about a schism that is that dramatic in terms of what people actually believe the country is. I don't think you can.
I think you're probably right, and I think from a leftist perspective, I don't think there's ever anything we can – you can't do anything right for a leftist. And I mean that literally, right or left. They're never going to believe that anything we ever do, short of total totalitarianism, is going to change anything they believe, because we're always going to screw this up. Now, you said net positive for the United States. I believe that we are a net positive. We're not perfect. And I think there's a lot of people out there who like to point out the things we aren't perfect about and haven't been for years, and, you know, slavery being one big thing. But, you know, we fought a war in 1861 to 1865 for the Civil War of the United States. Do you realize that in 1837 was when England got rid of slavery? It wasn't like it was 300 years ago. So we act like we were so far behind. Yes, we were behind. We should never have done it in the first place. But it wasn't that far behind what actually transpired in the rest of the world. You're lifting up us as a colonial power. We were not a colonial power compared to anything else in the world. We were not a colonial power.
We've never been. We don't colonize
other
nations.
Well, we don't call it colonization. Maybe Hawaiians feel like we took over.
That's right.
Okay, whatever. Are you better off now than you were then? Nobody from then is still alive today to tell us if it was better or worse. I think progress has its problems, but also staying rooted in the past completely has its problems as well. Everything in the past, we've talked about this with Dr. John Fia. The past that we think existed didn't exist. We're going to talk about it with another story here. Nothing we think existed back then actually was what you think it was. It was totally different time period. You brought up the 60s. I don't know what happened in the 60s. I wasn't alive in the 60s, so I don't know. But it seems like the world changed, you know, 180 degrees, something else. And I don't know why that was. It just was.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons.
That's the thing. There's one single reason that points to it.
Sure. But there's that whole cultural, the Frankfurt School, these sort of strains of kind of Marxist. That's what it is. I mean, leftism essentially derives from very Marxist ideas about how you create a utopia, about the anathema that is capitalism, about how central planning and government is literally the solution to all problems. And of course, the people that oppose this must somehow be done away with.
Re-educated.
In America, that translates into the modern social justice movement, which is these people need to be silenced. They need to be socially stigmatized. They need to be ostracized. And increasingly, we need to use the rule of law to punish them, perhaps criminalize their heretical views. Of course, in other countries, this experiment has led to death camps and gulags and 100 million dead, 45 million in 5 years under the Great Leap Forward. It's the same kind of thinking. I'm not suggesting that necessarily happens here. Of course not. We have a different government structure, but nevertheless, it's always the same, the authoritarian impulse to stamp out those who simply will not get with the program. Because you can't coerce progress when you have other people that are saying, we prefer not to.
Yeah.
Well, then they have to be made to comply.
Either comply or it doesn't work.
So the final thing I would say to Eric's question is, you know, if you're talking about influence in the political arena, I think another one of our problems is, and maybe this has always been true of politics, is that it is such a cesspit that how do you get – and there are good people. There are good, principled people who are trying to do the right thing in our political system. But I will say there's a whole bunch that aren't. Yeah. And there's a whole bunch that are simply there because it's an endless opportunity for graft and for feather bedding and for simply padding one's own nest, hanging out, ruling the lemmings from from D.C., and this sort of careerist class of politicians that stand for not much more than getting reelected is a problem. That, as you know, that was never what the founders envisioned politics to be about.
No.
These were citizen politicians. They were not intended nor ever expected to be in Washington for decades.
Well, it wasn't lucrative when they did it, and
it
wasn't the graft and corruption that made it lucrative.
And they were never expected to rely on that as their, not only just their career, but as a way to enrich themselves.
Right.
That would have been scandalous to anyone who drafted our founding documents.
I think a lot of people don't realize that the House of Representatives was designed with two-year terms because they were giving up to their business for just a short period of time to go back to their business. Abraham Lincoln served one term in the House by choice. He said, I only served one term and came home. It was to get experience. It was to get some contacts in the nation's capital. It was not to be a career. and it's become a career.
Right. Politics was a sacrifice.
That wasn't your title. When you put down in your taxes, what's your occupation? Politician was not supposed to be an occupation.
Right. I dare say that most people that are getting into politics, and again, there's people that are principled, that want to see what they believe to be the right policies enacted, but most people that are getting into politics these days are not expecting to live a life of austerity and sacrifice. They're expecting to get ahead because that's the game.
Well, they always talk about, I got to go in the private sector and make money. Really? There's a lot of people staying in the public sector for a lot of reasons.
And you look at, you could take example after example. I mean, the Clintons being among the best, but even someone like Harry Reid. There's a lot of people that are already wealthy, okay, that are in Congress. The Daryl Issas of the world.
Right.
There's a lot of very wealthy people already from private sector.
Which you had to be to get elected.
But what really should be troubling is how somebody who didn't come from wealth exits politics as an incredibly wealthy person. How does that happen?
It's amazing.
Well, that only
it?
Happens on the backs of the taxpayers and with lots of questionable deals. Uh-huh. And that should be why we say to ourselves, no. How does Harry Reid, a man from relatively middle class background, and there's a bunch of other people, exit his career, again, of sacrifice and public service, fabulously wealthy?
It does beg the question, doesn't it?
That's a problem.
Folks, they make $187,000 a year, which is not a small sum of money.
No.
But it's not going to make you a multimillionaire. I don't care what you're doing. It's not making you a multimillionaire without some other reason.
And what I always say, and we'll move on, but what I always say in the context of one of the debates about this, which is the notion of campaign finance reform, right? And people that say, well, there's too much money flowing into politics.
Uh-huh.
Do you know why, Chad? Because power attracts money.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to reduce immediately the amount of money that people are giving to politicians for no quid pro quo, just because they like them,
of course,
reduce the size and the influence of government.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. If government gets smaller and can't actually affect every aspect of everyone's life, there's no reason to funnel billions of dollars into D.C.
Nope.
You don't want as much money in politics? Reduce the power of politicians. Mm. But that, unfortunately for the left, it's completely at odds with their larger project. They want to grow government's power, yet somehow have people not recognize that they should continue to funnel money to the people that control everything. That's never going to work.
No.
Those two things are at cross purposes.
Nope. Yep. You got to get lobbyists. Certainly out of Congress. That's a big problem right there because they accept trips to wherever, fact-finding missions to wherever on somebody's dime to get them to vote certain ways. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work.
So I don't know if we answered Eric's question, but
Well, I don't think there is an answer to give him. How do you get these rational, fair and balanced thoughts out there? I don't know that you can in today's media. You keep trying, and that's the best you can do.
But you're never going to have, there's the occasional person that has a huge platform, but I think you just have to rely on other people finding you.
Yes. That reminds me. Spread the word. We're here. just in case you were wondering.
Our influence is vast and growing.
Yes, it's vast and growing. I'm going to talk about Maureen Shaw here. You familiar with Maureen Shaw?
Not real. I know Maureen Dowd. Who's Maureen Shaw?
Maureen Shaw
similar strain of thought.
Yeah, she works for NBC. She gave an opinion piece about Mike Pence, and I want to read the title of the article. Mike Pence says making abortion illegal saves lives. History proves the opposite.
Okay.
So a couple weeks ago, we talked about how many abortions are about 700,000 abortions per year. That's 700,000 children killed a year.
Yes.
Okay.
Or if you prefer uterine contents, that's the preferred Planned Parenthood nomenclature. Yes.
Okay. So she goes through this whole litany. In 1962 alone, there were nearly 1,600 women were admitted to Harlem Center Hospital Center in New York City for incomplete abortions. 700 women had septic abortions. She just goes on and on about how there were like 2,700 women in a year who.
And when was this?
In the 60s.
Right, because
prior to Roe versus Wade.
Medical technology has not changed
so
in the least.
2,700 women died. 700,000 babies were aborted.
She doesn't recognize that.
Well, that's the problem
that
right
dichotomy.
There.
Dichotomy, yeah.
To me, I mean, the math works like, I think that's more abortions, but here we work. So she says, conversely, legalized abortion saves lives. So if there's no legal abortion, women are still going to seek it out, and they're still going to have complications from abortions. And that may be true. She said that for Pence to deliver a triumphant speech exalting the efforts of anti-choice legislators and activists and encourage them to do the work until abortion is outlawed is essentially promoting the injury and death of women.
Well,
wow.
Well, okay, but here's the thing. The new everything, every policy that progressives oppose causes people to die. So this shouldn't be surprising. If you the tax cut is mm-hmm. going to cause people to die, and differing views on healthcare policy, well, of course, people are going to die.
With
their death rattle in the streets,
yep.
being denied access to emergency rooms, and energy policy, that's going to cause the whole world to be destroyed. Every person on the planet is going to die.
Yes.
So of course, a disagreement about abortion policy is going to cause more people to die. It just is.
Well,
that's the response to every progressive policy.
I got to read this. One cannot claim to respect the sanctity of life and also be willing to impose deadly consequences on a large fraction of the population. I'm going to say this, and it's some people are not going to like this. There is one way to avoid an unwanted pregnancy. Don't have sex. That's it. Nothing else is 100%. She goes on about contraception. Nothing else has been proven to be effective except abstinence. Now, if you're not willing to be abstinent, then you take the consequences of possibly getting pregnant.
No, you shouldn't have to, right?
That's the problem for me. The problem is you want this lifestyle choice that doesn't have the consequences of that lifestyle choice. And that's men and women both. I'm not just picking on the women. This is everybody. You choose to have sex, then you will have consequences. Sometimes that's good. Maybe you want to have a child. Maybe you don't. And the people who want to have abortions obviously don't. But you shouldn't live your life acting as though it's
right.
without
but the
consequence.
The other interesting thing about that article, and it's actually not even that interesting because this is what most of these pro-choice people say, is they don't even recognize that there is another life in the equation.
Correct.
They simply don't.
Doesn't
now,
exist until it's born.
Here is the salient point about this. Let's step aside from the biological reality that life begins at conception. Okay, mm-hmm. Because again, this is supposedly a person of science, right? She's
yes.
actually more of a person of a sciency person. It's not science; it's something else. But let's step away from that. Even though there is absolutely nothing controversial about that statement, it's actually bedrock scientific.
It's controversial in my opinion, but it's not controversial to society. I agree. And from a leftist.
It's not controversial at all from an empirical biological reality. It's controversial as a political statement.
Correct.
Okay. However, so let's remove that and talk about what we know about a baby in the womb at, say, 22 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the reasons, of course, that people like this woman who wrote that article don't like showing people ultrasounds, don't like any of that, is because it is impossible for them to argue that this is not a human being at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, with the organs that have formed, heartbeat, all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who claims that they're pro-science but somehow says what we're looking at there is not a distinct human life, well, you know that they're lying.
Mm-hmm.
They're lying because they have a political agenda. So what this woman would presumably say, and I guarantee she would say this, because when you press them on this, is up till – I always ask people this in this discussion about, well, we – you know, nobody likes abortion. Okay. At what point would it be okay to abolish this procedure? First –
you mean at what
– what stage?
Week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Would it be first trimester? Well, no, it's between – second – well, no, not then. Third? And let's – even if you grant, which I do not because – if it's a life, you really can't have exceptions, right? But let's just say we'll grant you if the life of the mother is at stake, rape, incest, the usual things that get thrown in there, that let's take those out of the equation and just focus on when would it be permissible for the government from a moral perspective to say, if you haven't been raped, you're not a victim of incest, your life is not at risk. When is it okay to say you can't just abort that child? And usually the answer you will get, you will never get an answer. What they will say is that simply remains between the woman and her doctor. And the translation of that is up literally until the time of crowning is when, in fact, the Born Alive In for Protection Act, okay, which was a the media sort of completely hid this. Barack Obama, when he was a senator and a state senator,
right,
voted against that. Okay, in fact, I actually think he did it when he was a senator in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
And what did that act say? That act said that when a baby is born alive after a botched abortion, the medical provider then has a duty to try to save the baby's life. And the abortion lobby and the abortion crusaders, including Barack Obama, who is the most radically pro-abortion, I use that term intentionally, president we have ever had, said, no, we can't even support that, which is essentially infanticide.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that is. Mm-hmm. If you're making moral distinctions based on uterine geography, meaning inside the wall, outside the wall, as somehow that living being takes on a different moral status, you're not engaging in science, Chad.
No. Well, Hillary Clinton did that 2 years ago when she was running for president. She was okay. It was murder outside the womb, but it was okay inside the womb. And right up until the moment it came in to the OR when they were delivering, it was still, you could still abort it. As soon as it came out, then it was murder.
Right. And so again, let's not pretend that you're taking any sort of scientific position. If that's your view, you're taking an ideological position, because to you, abortion is sacrosanct and it's your holy of holies and it cannot be questioned. But the idea that you have any respect for science or morality, for that matter, is a joke. Okay. You've just decided it's okay to kill babies because that's a politically expedient position for us to take, because we value choice. And to your point, actually, you had time to make a choice.
Yeah,
you made a choice, and now you want to make another choice to absolve you of your original choice.
Yeah, we want the day after pill given to everybody so they can just have whatever they want.
I mean, I would have loved someone. In fact, I think Rand Paul said this at one point during the Republican primaries, and he was asked this because he's a doctor. And, you know,
optician. Right.
But they look at it, and all doctors are the same, Chad. Okay. They all know about all these things.
He knows
but
his
no,
eyes.
It was one of these gotcha questions where he was being asked about abortion. And I think it maybe had been like the rape or incest question. I forget. But his response was, I'll answer that question after you go ask Hillary whether it's okay to abort a 9-month-old fetus.
Yeah.
Okay. And of course, they will never ask her that question.
No.
This whole thing also about women dying, there are already women dying in the existing abortion clinics.
Yeah, it's less than it was, but it's still there.
Of course it's less than it was, and they fight any regulation of those clinics because that's also an intrusion on Roe v. Wade. The Kermit Gosnell trial from Philadelphia, you want to read something horrific. Read about that case.
Yeah.
I mean, this was literally, this was a horror movie beyond, you know, Clive Barker's imagination or Stephen King's imagination. This man killing live babies that had been delivered by stabbing them in the spine and severing their spinal cord, keeping babies' heads and organs in jars. I mean, this was something out of a nightmare.
And he was prosecuted.
He was, but did the media did everything they could to simply avert their gaze from this. And again, I'm not saying that every abortion clinic is run like Kermit Gosnell's clinic, but the reality is that's what they're there to do.
Yeah.
We don't
want to see how the sausage is made. And I'm not comparing babies to sausage, but that's the whole thing. If you knew how it was done, you wouldn't be in favor of it. And I think that's very true with abortions. Now, I have a question for you. I have a friend, a female friend, who is pro-choice for every other woman. She is pro-life for herself, but she believes in women's right to choose. Now, I don't know how you can have both views.
Well, but that's actually the straddle that a lot of people will say is, you know, personally, I'm opposed to it, but I don't feel like I can impose my views on someone else. Okay, so what's your question?
Well, my question is, how is that possible? How can you have that? If you believe in life, how can you say, it's okay, I would never, ever do that, but I think it's okay for somebody else to do it if you believe in life? Because I don't think you can believe in life, in pro-life, and then say it's okay for 700,000 other people to do that.
Well, I think the only way that you can take that position is you're basically taking the position that then the government has no right to implement any policy
which
in some way limits or prohibits or restricts someone's choice in any area.
But the they do.
Well, that's the point. The problem is, I mean, I don't know this woman. I'm talking about her specifically. But progressives in general, other than abortion, that's their entire goal,
right?
Which is government will tell you what size sodas you have to drink and what cars you should drive and what energy you should use and what words you're allowed to say or not say and what cakes you must bake and what photographs you must take and what bathrooms you must allow.
Yeah.
Oh,
but you can't
in this area. Do not even think of going there. And, of course, the criticism of conservatives is always, you want to get into women's bedrooms. And yet I would ask you, in terms of the political spectrums today, the political parties, if you're going to identify the party that is all about telling other people how they must live down to the finest detail of their life, who is that going to be, Chad?
It's going to be the Democrats every time.
Every time. Except for, well, when it comes to this, just butt out.
Yes.
Because choice. Now, I've said I'm a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is very clear, based on God's word, that killing an infant in the womb is a sin.
It's a bad thing.
It is immoral. But here's the thing. My position is not that, well, I can't judge that conduct. I absolutely, first of all, I'm not judging it. God has already judged it.
Right.
Okay, so I'm just telling you, based on what God has said, this is wrong. And since he's the only moral standard by which we should be governed as a Christian,
right,
that's a very simple thing for me to say. And I'm more than happy to say, yes, that is wrong. Okay. Now, from a political standpoint, I've said this before, my position is I would be content as someone who lives in a democracy that as it existed pre-Roe, which most people don't understand.
You want to go state by state?
I'm content to go state by state. Now, look, I may not be happy about what the people of my particular state decide on that issue, but I am content to have that as a solution.
Well, it's actually a legislative solution versus
that's the point.
Dictate on high.
Instead of having nine philosopher kings and queens tell us what the penumbras of the Constitution should allow. One of the things about this debate that literally, I guarantee you, you go on to do the sidewalk interviews, you ask 100 people, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, does abortion become illegal? 90 of them say, yes, that's terrible.
And 10% don't know what Roe v. Wade is.
Right, that's true. They don't know what Roe v. Wade is. They think it has something to do with Russia. That's not true. And I don't remember the exact split, but I think before Roe, there may have been...
I think there was 26 states prior to Roe that were pro-abortion.
Something along that.
Yes.
So, but progressives don't want that solution.
No.
And by the way, most of the time that these issues have been put up on referenda, including not only abortion, but gay marriage, they lose.
Correct.
Which is why they would prefer judicial diktat.
Sure.
Because that's how they enact...
Are you referring to Proposition 8 in California that struck down homosexual marriage but went to the Supreme Court and won?
Well, not only struck it down, and then the Ninth Circus decided that can't stand.
Yeah. Even though it was given to the people to choose, they didn't want the people to choose. I agree with you. I think that if you have a legislative opportunity to change things, that's where it comes from. And if somebody else gets into control, they can try to change it. Back.
I don't really admire, but what I at least appreciate is someone like, for instance, we've talked about him before, someone like Peter Singer, who is a leftist, he's a bioethicist, he fully embraces not only abortion, but literally infanticide. He also embraces euthanasia for elderly people. At least have the courage of your convictions and say, you know what? We recognize that science demonstrates that this is a baby. We think it's okay to kill that baby because it's not out of the womb, and we value the choices of the mother for political reasons over that life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would at least be an intellectually honest position. They will never say
because
it's morally repugnant, and they recognize that.
That's the problem. They know it.
They know it, and they know – and here's the thing. When you do polling on this – even younger people, okay, who are supposedly the vanguard of the, you know, the coming utopia when they're going to kick out all of the old white people that are unenlightened, even younger people now, when you do polling on this, are becoming increasingly disenchanted and opposed to abortion, particularly later term abortions.
Sure.
So, you know, that article is pretty much standard fodder for what you hear. Yeah. I don't think it's very persuasive at all.
No, it's her opinion, and I would take her dictate to a different level. In her opinion, making abortion illegal causes back alley abortions, causes problems for women. Let's take it another step. Let's make every narcotic, every drug legal in controlled controlled circumstances so that everybody can take whatever they want. They can walk into an office building and take whatever they
want.
Well,
there's a lot of people that have
that. There are those people. But we also recognize taking heroin is not a good thing. You might feel good for a period of time, short period of time, it gets shorter and shorter. But it's not a good thing for your long-term health. Taking, you know, extra pain pills, Oxycontin, you know, fistfuls of Oxycontin is not a good thing for your health-wise. But we understand that. So there are some people who want to legalize those things, but not a vast majority of people. Marijuana, sure, they want to legalize that everywhere because they don't see the problem with that. I think when you expand that out, we talked about, you know, I want to marry a tree. I want to be a tall building. You can go to extremes for everything, and I think abortion is that extreme for me, and I don't like it, but that's the law of the land. Not the law of the land. It's the dictate of the land at the moment, and I'd like to see it overturned, but that hasn't happened yet. So,
and we'll see if the court. I don't think the court has the stomach to really revisit it, but
I don't either.
You never know.
I don't either. Well, we'll see. Another wonderful opinion poll from Joy Reid of AM Joy.
Joy is the best.
I don't know if AM Joy is the right word for what I see from her. But she put out an opinion also on the Daily Beast called "The Right Can't Fight the Future." Okay?
The future.
The future. She says, "Today Trump is speeding us toward decline, the very decline his supporters feared." I don't know that's true.
Does she give us some particulars?
No, she does. "In every way, Donald Trump is a president built for the past, a benighted late 19th century figure who spun his supporters a tale that he could restore a bygone era when coal fires burned, factories hummed, stimulus belched out soot and opportunity, and a white man with a sturdy back, a high school diploma, and a song in his heart could buy a little house, marry a little wife, and have three cherry-cheeked kids who didn't ever have to cook, clean for, or plus, if he can afford it, a hot mistress on the side." I don't remember any of that in the run-up to the election. I don't remember him talking about, let's bring back the 19th century, but okay.
Well, that's what every Republican president wants to do, right? Actually, I'm glad she's moved us into the 19th century. It's usually the Middle Ages. So we've moved forward a little bit.
She says, "The rural folks were the salt of the earth, and we only let in, quote, a certain kind of immigrant whose only goal was to shake off his ethnicity and assimilate." Like, it's a bad thing to assimilate for some reason.
Right, of course it is.
"Everyone went to separate churches on Sundays, and everyone got along. It's a plasticine world that for many must feel like it truly existed, though, of course, it never did." So she's saying this is what Donald Trump wanted to take us to, but we all agree it never actually lived that way. "Immigrants aren't going away, and in fact, we need them to keep the economy and the safety net flush." What does that mean? We need them to keep the safety net flush.
Well, I guess that means that they're going to pay taxes, which are going to go to the safety net.
Sure, they are.
But that's generally not true, Joy.
Not at all. She goes on. "Meanwhile, there's another America which is busy concerning itself with the future. It's the America that produces 2/3 of this country's economic output, though it represents just hundreds of counties versus Trump's thousands. It's the America that objects to Russian interference in elections." We all object to that. We all object to that, Joy.
No. I am in favor, strongly in favor of Boris and Natasha's attacks on democracy.
"It's an America that welcomes immigrants and their economic contributions." So somebody crossing the border from Mexico, do they have a lot of economic contribution early on?
Well, but again, note, Joy makes no distinction, which is par for the course, between illegal immigrants and legal immigrants. They're all the same.
It's all the same to her.
It's an undifferentiated
exactly.
mass of people. Okay.
See, this is America that recognizes even ancient institutions like marriage can modernize. Ancient institutions? Okay.
Modernize.
Yep.
I like that.
"That views women's full equality as a boon, not a threat to civilization." Who has ever said that women's equality is a threat to civilization?
I think that is also a threat.
Okay. "That doesn't want to be ruled from biblical text or by a savage gun lobby, and it wants America to be part of the world, not its creaky, cranky, lonely adversary.
So we're either ruled by a theocracy, Well,
we're all bad people, man.
You either say the Nicene Creed or you're going to the camps, or we're ruled by the NRA.
And lastly, she says, and by next year, millennials will be the single largest generational group in America, with their ranks swelled by immigrants, which explains the urgent right-wing push to mass deportation.
Hey, Joy, here's a problem. They don't vote.
Exactly. They could be the biggest group, but they don't vote.
It's all those old, cranky white people who climb in their jacked-up pickups and drive to the polls. The millennials are watching John Oliver in their basement and sending out hashtag memes during the time that the polls are open. So you better fix that.
And last thing. Perhaps the biggest challenge future-facing America faces is that past-craving America has a dogmatic and consistent voting base and a determined and persistent ally, Russia, which alongside its embedded mercenaries from the so-called alt-right are harnessing maturing modern tools like social media to keep the futurists at bay. But we won't have a president who cuddles up to Russia and neo-fascists forever. Eventually, the fight against them and their propaganda will be joined in earnest and won. Yet 2 years ago, Russia was our buddy. Now they're our enemy. We'll cuddle up to them.
Joy has woke to the red.
Wow. Joy Reid.
I mean, that's pretty good, even for Joy. I mean, she's kind of a caricature, but that was that was a good effort.
That was her article of the Daily Beast yesterday.
Yeah. Isn't she the one that mocked Mitt Romney for having an adopted
That I don't know.
I think that might have been her.
She's mocked everything that's not left.
Well, no, but in openly sort of racist terms. I may be getting her wrong. I'm almost positive it was her. She's not very compelling in the things that she says. Let's put it that way. I'm trying to be charitable to Julie.
She's preaching to the choir on that one. She's given, you know, the dog whistle. She's doing the dog whistle for the progressives. I'm trying to look up Mitt Romney and Joy Reid here.
Yeah, it's not. I may be wrong about that. I know it was somebody that was because she's MSNBC, right?
Yes.
I think it was her. It was her or some other person.
Mitt Romney breaks silence over MSNBC attack on adopted black grandson.
And who was the
blast Melissa Harris Perry.
Melissa Harris. I'm sorry, Joy. Joy, I did not mean
that
to,
was not you.
That right. That was
it. Could have been you, but it was not you.
That was another person that would have written exactly the same article that you wrote, but it was not you. So we stand corrected.
She hasn't persuaded you that we're in bed with the Russians and trying to whatever.
No. But maybe if I sleep on it, I will come around to her.
Maybe we've got another Christopher Steele sighting. Mitt Romney.
Yes.
Was almost Secretary of State. Let's play this.
Russia says it blocked former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney from becoming Secretary of State. The New Yorker reported that an unpublished memo from former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele said that the Kremlin influenced Donald Trump to pick a more Russian-friendly choice. The report also suggests that Steele may have discussed the memo with special counsel Robert Mueller's team. The memo apparently claimed that Russia reached out to Trump to ask for a Secretary of State that would lessen sanctions on the country. And when the dust settled, Romney was not offered the job, and Trump instead went with former ExxonMobil chief Rex Tillerson, who had done business with Putin and Russia. Steele released a 35-page dossier in January of 2017 that alleged that Russia and Trump were closely linked and wanted to help him in the 2016 election, claims which President Trump and the White House have called fake.
I'm calling fake on that as well.
Well, but you know what? This is an interesting question. Why would we be surprised if Russia, another government that we... Of course, again, the Obama administration engaged in all sorts of diplomacy with Russia. Why would we be surprised if the Russian government said to any incoming president, listen, we really don't want this particular person to be Secretary of State. It's going to harm relations between our countries. He is openly hostile to us. And we would ask that you consider someone else who's a more moderate choice. Is there anything inherently wrong with that, Chad?
Nothing illegal, nothing
wrong. Is there anything surprising that that would go on? No. So I actually think that's fake as well, because Christopher Steele, anything from him now is completely there's a rebuttable presumption that it's baloney. But again, this notion – now here's the best part of this. What was the Obama administration engaged in as his main legacy-building project with what country?
Well, Iran.
Iran. And were do you think Iran was making entreaties to the Obama administration about, hey, listen, we'd really appreciate it if you would kind of drop those sanctions and lift that conventional weapons embargo and give us a whole bunch of cash? Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that since Iran is the chief global sponsor of terrorism, an avowed enemy of this country, I think they chant death to the great Satan.
They do.
Fairly
we
regularly.
We are the great Satan.
According to that analysis, the Obama administration was engaged in some sort of nefarious conspiracy to collude with Iran against America's interests. Weren't they, Chad?
They were. They got John Kerry to do that. So obviously it worked. My contention, I have two problems with that whole, other than it's Christopher Steele, which means it's a load of crap. One, I think Russia wanted somebody more favorable to them, but I don't think they called up Trump and said, hey, could you give us somebody else? Because I don't think that happens.
And by the way,
I just don't think that
happens.
Wait,
the other thing is, if I understand the collusion sock puppet narrative correctly, all Vlad Putin would have to do is hit the red button that would stimulate the microchip in Trump's head, and he would immediately have put in whoever he wanted, Yakov Smirnov, whoever.
He's dead now, but yes.
Yes, or his son, or, yes. I mean, Alex Ovechkin, whoever they wanted. Why would they have to ask, Chad?
They wouldn't have to ask.
They control
the
White House.
So my second problem is, they act as though the Secretary of State unilaterally makes decisions that have no input from the president or anybody else. I'm going to be the Secretary of State. They've been watching Madam Secretary too much. You don't have that much power. You can't just negotiate and say, well, you know, that sounds good. We're good. Let's get out of here. That doesn't work that way. So to think that whoever you put in can unilaterally make any of those decisions is ridiculous.
Well, the other thing is, if they were smart, what they should have told Donald Trump is, we demand that you make Barack Obama
your
Secretary of State.
Because we know we can run over him.
That's right. He curled into the fetal position and let us do anything we wanted.
It's just,
could you please let him be the Secretary of State now that he's post-president?
I feel like they're doubling down on this whole the Russian thing because it makes no sense. None. None at all. Forget it. I got to move on. We said we'd talk about LeBron and Durant.
All right. This may prompt another
It probably will.
Call
let me give you the number. 717-739-5432. 717-739-5432.
This is also a warning to at least one of our listeners. This is now
going
to be 5 minutes of sports talk. So you might want to go have an eclair or something.
Yes.
Can they fast forward this?
They can.
Okay. Yeah,
if they want. You don't have to. You can listen.
So here's – this is part of my my mission, my responsibility to the public, and I think we should do this sort of every quarter or every 6 months, particularly as we always approach the playoffs because we can –
Playoffs?
Yes. Talk about playoffs? We continually hear, and this is sort of, you know, it starts with the mothership, ESPN, but this constant need to say, this is the year, this is the year, this is the time that LeBron James has surpassed Michael Jordan.
Well, he got his third MVP for the All-Star game because, you know, exhibition games count towards legacy.
Right. So we simply need to do a little bit of remedial education because, again, you know, Jordan played his last season with the Washington Wizards, I think, was it 99?
It was 2000.
2000? Okay, yeah. So we're 18 years out.
Yeah.
And
there are college students who've never seen him play.
Most of the people that are writing for ESPN and people like Nick Wright, they never saw Jordan play in his prime. And so this is very simple because this is science. This is not even really subjective. I mean, I say that jokingly, but not really. LeBron will never, ever, ever be better than Jordan. And I say that from two perspectives. One of them meaning you can't surpass the guy that went 6-for-6 in the finals when your record is now, I believe, 3-5.
2003. Last year with the Wizards.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's a long time ago, right? And that was when he was over the hill in a shadow of himself and yet still managed to average over 20 points a game in the new and evolved NBA. But we don't need to talk about that. LeBron, from a resume standpoint, can never surpass Jordan because LeBron has simply had too many failures in the finals. Now, We can talk about, well, some of those they shouldn't have won. He had a far inferior team. That's correct. But there are at least two of them that they were favored when he played for Miami. And he simply he disappeared.
Yeah.
Now look, let me preface this also by saying LeBron right now is clearly in the pantheon. LeBron is one of the best, in my view, five or six who have ever played. Okay. You've got Jordan, you've got Russell, you've got Jabbar. In my view, those are the top three of all time in that
Chamberlain?
Order. Maybe Chamberlain. I wouldn't put him there. I mean, statistically, Chamberlain is an outlier. I mean, he's done things that no one has ever done. Part of that is because he was so good. Part of that is the era that he played in. Mm-hmm. Freakishly athletic seven-footers just
quite a bit taller than most other players.
I mean, my view is that if Will Chamberlain played in this era or even in Jordan's era when you had Hakeem Olajuwon and David Robinson and Patrick Ewing, his athletic ability would not have been as freakish as it was in the era that he played. He would not have averaged 50 points a game.
Agreed.
So, but Chamberlain is up there, you know, top 10. LeBron's in the top five, in my view. I mean, he's incredible. And he may, when he is done, he may have a very solid argument that he is number two behind only Jordan.
Number two, really?
I think he might.
Okay.
Now, again, no one's ever going to surpass Russell's 11 titles. No. So if you go by titles, many people would say Bill Russell still has to be number one. Again, the issue for me with Bill Russell, tremendous competitor, sort of on Jordan level in terms of his pathological competitiveness. But again, he's a guy that was somewhat limited offensively, one of the best defensive centers of all time, played for the greatest dynasty of all time, the Red Auerbach Celtics. But again, you take Bill Russell, plug him into today's NBA, is he going to dominate to that extent? I don't think so. Meanwhile, you take Jordan or LeBron out of, you put them in any era, and they're going to dominate. In fact, you put them back in that era, and they're going to be like space aliens. So, you can't, if we're going to have a conversation about the GOAT, every part of the resume is going to get scrutinized.
Mm-hmm.
And Jordan never had the kind of failures that, which LeBron has vindicated himself. He's a champion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, he brought it, good grief. He brought a title to Cleveland. That's impossible.
Yeah,
right?
Hasn't happened since Jim Brown.
But he has never, I mean, he has those two finals in particular where he was the best player in the league. He simply didn't perform.
Mm-hmm.
His team should have won. They didn't win. Now, that's the first part of this. You're never going to surpass the 6-for-6. I don't care how many finals, consecutive finals you go to. But more importantly, and this is the one that actually I think drives me the craziest. This Nick Wright guy, I mean, he's just representative. Okay, he looks like he's about 23 years old, right? He's always on with Colin Cowherd talking about how LeBron, he's actually made the statement, and others have made this, LeBron is better at every aspect of basketball than Michael Jordan.
Wow, that's quite a statement.
That is, that I think qualifies him for certain levels of medical, serious medical treatment. And again, it is indicative of someone who's never actually watched Jordan in his prime. Because I would argue the only thing that LeBron is better at Jordan than.
The crab dribble?
The crab dribble, he's a better passer. He's actually a much better passer. LeBron is one of the most gifted passers, particularly for his size, that the NBA has ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Wow.
Now people say, well, how can you say that? Okay, LeBron is bigger.
Sure.
He's physically bigger, and he's stronger if by strength you mean he's a larger human being.
Mm-hmm.
Because pound for pound, I don't think LeBron is any stronger than Jordan. Scoring, Jordan's better. Shooting, Jordan is better. And anyone who has watched, now people say, oh, well, LeBron's three-point percentage. LeBron has become a much better jump shooter. Jordan is a vastly superior shooter. If you've watched either of them play, and I've watched pretty much the whole career of both of these guys, infinitely better mid-range jump shooter than LeBron.
Okay.
Far better foul shooter. Okay, I think their career foul shooting percentage, LeBron is somewhere in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Jordan is mid-80s. He's 85%. He's an elite free throw shooter. Jordan is quicker. Jordan has better body control. Jordan is a better, far better half-court player than LeBron in terms of his ability to get to the basket. Now, I can guarantee our friend is going to be screaming at that. Here's the thing. LeBron is playing in an era where you can't touch a 6'9", 260-pound linebacker. Jordan played in an era, as we have pointed out repeatedly, where the Bad Boys and the Riley Knicks could concuss you on the way to the hoop.
And tried every time.
And you would not even be called for a flagrant foul. And you could hand check a perimeter player and literally stick your arm on their hip. If if Primo Jordan, if Come Fly With Me Jordan was in this league, he would score 45 points a game without breaking a sweat. So, yes, Jordan was a much better half-court offensive player. Jordan was a better post player. You say, how can you say that? LeBron's bigger. LeBron, who has developed a fadeaway, has no fadeaway, no weapon equivalent to Jordan's fadeaway, which had become basically one of the two or three best post moves in the league.
Mm-hmm.
People say that LeBron is a better defensive player. Incorrect. Gong. Buzzer. Drop through the floor. That is incorrect. What they mean is LeBron can guard more positions. That is true. He's bigger, which means he can play the five, he can play the four, and he on occasion will guard perimeter players. LeBron's a very good defensive player. In terms of guarding his position, because by the way, Chad, how frequently does the player actually have to guard? Is LeBron guarding centers most of the time?
No.
No. So when it comes to evaluating someone for guarding your position, Jordan was the best perimeter one-on-one defender in the league for pretty much every season that he played. He actually won Defensive Player of the Year while leading the league in scoring.
Exactly.
That is impossible. LeBron James has never been Defensive Player of the Year,
probably,
and I think he may have won one scoring title. To lead the league in scoring 10 times while also being first-team all-defense, again, that is inhuman.
Mm-hmm.
It takes too much energy to do that.
That's why they don't play defense a lot of times.
Jordan is a better one-on-one defender than LeBron. Guarding his position, he is more dominant, he's more ferocious, he's the guy that you would want shutting someone down. You know what LeBron is better at? He is better at running behind people and tracking down and blocking shots. That's a very particular skill set.
Sure.
He did it in the finals. That's probably the most famous block in the finals when they beat the Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not a better defensive player. He just isn't.
You mean he can't do the going up in the finals, put the ball in one hand, switch it to the other hand, and put it in the basket? Come
right.
on.
But and here's the final thing. So the final, all of these objective attributes, Jordan is better. He just is. When it comes to ruthless, competitive, pathological fury, there is no one that has ever been like Michael Jordan. And this is not a knock on LeBron James, who is a champion,
yeah.
who has played, I mean, he's done amazing things. Again, he could arguably go down as the second greatest player
third.
Who has ever lived. Okay, you say third. Who's number two?
Jabbar.
Jabbar's going to be there? Okay,
Sky
that's
hook.
Fine.
Don't
yeah,
tell
that's
him.
True.
Nobody stopped the Skyhook.
Who are you going to pick, Chad,
mm-hmm.
in the game to save the galaxy?
Michael Jordan. It was in Space Jam. Obviously, that's...
Not even in Space Jam. Who's the guy that's going to take the final shot?
Jordan.
There's not a single person. I don't care. You could find Nick Wright and hook him up to a polygraph machine and say, Nick, who is going to take the final shot in the game to save civilization? And Nick Wright is going to splutter out over and over, Jordan, 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 Jordan. Everyone understands this. That's not a knock on LeBron.
No.
LeBron's great. LeBron has made clutch shots. He isn't Jordan. Part of the reason he isn't Jordan is because Jordan is actually a very unhealthy individual in some
yes.
ways off of the basketball court.
Yes.
On a basketball court,
that's what you want.
You couldn't have generated this guy in a laboratory.
Correct. So I agree with almost everything you've said except for number two. I still think it's Jabbar. But there's stories about
I want you to push back on this quickly.
Okay.
You need to channel Eric and say why this is wrong.
Well, let me give my points on why I agree with you, because you talk about Russell. I don't think Russell's in my top 10. And here's why. There were eight teams in the league when Russell played. Eight teams. That doesn't have to go through a lot of people to get to the finals and win the finals. Secondly, he was on a very good team with a lot of other talented players. It wasn't like he was doing everything himself. Very good player, not doing everything
sure.
himself. I challenge anybody to say that Emmitt Smith is the best running back in the NFL history.
I actually think Eric would say that.
Well, Eric would be wrong.
Because Eric loves Emmitt Smith.
That's great. You can love Emmitt Smith. He's not a bad running back, but just because he has the most yards rushing does not make him the best running back. Jim Brown was a better running back than Emmitt Smith. Gale Sayers, Sweetness, come on. These were better running backs because they just were. Emmitt Smith had a great line. So get the numbers out of the way. I think you have to have at least a title to even be in the discussion. Charles Barkley can't ever even be in the discussion because
well,
he never won.
And let me just jump in real quick on that, is that that's incredibly true of the NBA.
Yes, not in football. In
because
football,
because a single transcendent player in the NBA is it makes it so much easier because they can control so many more things that if you're not going to win a title, you better be really, really close because you could simply dominate in so many ways. Like sure. You said, a football team, a baseball team, that's just not true.
Right, right. Nobody is sitting here saying that some of these people haven't played well, haven't played long careers, but it doesn't make you the best because of that. LeBron had more points faster than Jordan. Okay, that's fine.
Well, wait. He had more points playoff faster. Points. No, he had more points faster, meaning his age.
Correct.
He had Jordan,
he started at 18.
Jordan's per-game scoring average in the regular season in the playoffs is substantially higher than LeBron.
Yes, it is.
So, in other words, if you go game by game, LeBron's not close to that. The reason he had more points faster is simply because he came into the league out of high school.
18 versus 21.
Right.
You're
that's
great.
An important
and Jordan lost his first season with a broken leg.
Second season.
Okay.
He was rookie of the year's first season.
All right. Second season, most of the season, he was lost with a broken leg. Not hurt from that point on. He came back. When Jordan came back, he played in every game.
Right.
When LeBron can't say that.
Well, that's an interesting point because a lot of people, and look, LeBron is a remarkable specimen in terms of being an Iron Man because he plays tons and tons of games. He has an incredible workload, and Eric's very big on a lot of the advanced statistics, and LeBron has had an incredible,
sure.
Because of course they make these deep playoff runs every season.
Yeah.
But it is worth pointing out to what you just said, that when Jordan came back from his baseball sabbatical, some people say David Stern kicked him out for gambling.
Hiatus.
Right. 304 of 304 games. He
yes.
didn't miss a single. Nope. LeBron, I believe, has only had one season. No. I don't think he's ever had a single season where he played all 82 games.
He hasn't.
I think Jordan has had something like 9 seasons that he played every game. Now, do I blame LeBron for being a smart guy in this era where he says,
no.
You know what? I'm taking nights off. I think the one season, 2 years ago, he basically took a 2-week sabbatical.
Yep. When
that's
Miami
great.
Played around.
But remember, we're having a conversation about who is the greatest of all time. If you're going to take 2-week sabbaticals to recharge, Jordan didn't do any of that stuff.
No.
And again, he's playing in the thug ball era.
Correct.
Not the phantom foul. You breathed on me. That's a flagrant 2. You're out of the game.
Except it was Vlade Divac. That was
that's
the
right.
Time. All that being said, LeBron is a very good player.
No, he's not very good. He's one of the greatest players.
He is
of
one
all
of the
time.
Greatest. But in my opinion, it's still not number one. He can't.
No.
You can't take time off and be considered a great player because great players don't take time off. You have to win every chance you get, and he doesn't. He muddles through the regular season. I know Eric doesn't like to hear that. He muddles through the regular season just getting to the playoffs. Maybe that's how you save yourself, but guess what? Jordan never would have said, I'm okay to lose tonight. I don't care who it is.
Well, I don't think
I'm
it's
not
so
okay
much
with
that,
losing.
I don't think LeBron is saying it's okay to lose. But
he doesn't care if they only win 50 games.
It has become very clear the last 2 seasons. I think Eric would even acknowledge this because anyone who watches the NBA, including LeBron fans, have said his defense has taken a major dive. Now, look, he'll crank it back up for the playoffs. But to your point, every game for Jordan was like a blood feud. It didn't matter whether he was playing in, Toronto
yep.
in the middle of February with, of course, there was always fans there because they came to see Jordan.
Correct.
For him, it was, I must crush you no matter what day, what time, whether I'm feeling good, not feeling good,
doesn't
I'm going to show up and try to rip your throat out. That's simply who he was. No one else has ever been that way. The closest guy, honestly, I know a lot of people say Kobe. Kobe was competitive. The closest guy is probably Larry Bird. Larry
yeah.
Bird had that same mindset of not just winning, but I want to humiliate you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to embarrass you. I want to emasculate you. I want you to feel so horrible and defeated that you are psychologically destroyed and pose no threat to me in the future. That's the way that Jordan thought about everything. LeBron just doesn't think that way.
No, and you brought up the fans come out to see Jordan because they knew they were getting a show every night. LeBron doesn't give a crap about the fans. He's said that over. They've seen me play before. I'm not going to Memphis.
Well,
I'm going
to
take some time
okay.
off.
I mean, that's true. I don't think it's that he doesn't give a crap about the fans.
Well, he also doesn't give a crap about his owner either.
Well, they don't like each other.
Doesn't matter which owner. Because if you take time off and you play half defense whenever you feel like it and you're still wanting max dollars, then you're underselling what you're doing. You're being paid to be the man. So the man shows up and does his job.
Okay, but here's the thing. I do have to defend LeBron on that only because that's an organizational decision. Okay, it's not like the coaching. This is the same thing with the Spurs, right?
Sure.
Popovich is the guy.
I don't agree with that either.
Right, but Popovich is the guy that sort of popularized this thing where he said, look, I'm going to rest Tim Duncan and Tony Parker and now, you know, Kawhi Leonard. Multiple games a year because the whole goal is to win a championship, and this is the best way to do it. It's not as if the organization and the coaching staff is telling LeBron, we really want you to play. This is an agreed-upon strategy for them to win. So I don't really put that at LeBron's feet. But what
the 2 weeks off he took 2 years ago to go, man, that's him. That was him making that
decision. That's true.
And not playing full defense.
My only point is that I'm not criticizing you in this era for doing that in isolation, but what I am saying is, and he has made no bones about the fact, I'm chasing the ghost.
Sure.
If you're chasing that guy, you don't get to do that.
Correct.
And if you do it, people get to point out that the guy you're chasing doesn't take games off to rest for the playoffs.
No.
This is now a binary selection. You have willingly placed yourself into the discussion of, I want to be better. And by the way, I don't blame LeBron for that.
Sure.
He wants to be the greatest.
That's fine.
But then we're going to talk about this stuff, LeBron, and you don't get to say, well, this is just the way it's done right now. That's fine. That's not the way that guy would have done it. Because you can tell Michael Jordan playing right now, can you imagine if someone went to him and said, listen, we think you should probably take a week off so that you can recharge for the playoffs.
No,
he would have probably strangled them in the locker room.
No, thanks. Not going to do that. That's my point. You have to be out there all the time playing 100%. If you are not, if you're taking a playoff or taking a few minutes to recover, maybe you need to do that, then you can't say you're the greatest. You cannot say you're the greatest.
Realistically, every human being, okay, in the course of some game is going to say, okay, I didn't play great defense on that possession. But there is no doubt that when it comes to, you know, an obsessive, hyper-competitive, velociraptor mindset, Michael Jordan is simply at a different level. And that's one of the reasons why, in terms of, you know, clutch shooting, who do you want with the ball? He's the only answer. Yeah. He is the only answer.
Well, he wanted the ball at the end of every game. He didn't always get it, but he wanted the ball at the end of every game.
And I think
LeBron is on record of saying, I don't want the ball at the end of every game, early in his career.
Exactly. And that's the point, is that LeBron has gotten better.
Sure.
LeBron has evolved. LeBron has become a closer. I mean, one of the but that's to his credit. The point is that he's not hardwired that way.
No, he isn't.
Jordan's DNA from the beginning was, give me the ball, I'm going to murder you.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen. And you know what? I don't care if I take 35 shots in a row and miss every one. The next shot for the game is mine, and it's going in. Right. That's how he thought.
Yeah.
That's just not how LeBron was wired.
And there's nothing wrong with that, except, and I know Eric's head is exploding right now as he's listening to this.
Oh, yes. We may need to leave like 10 minutes for a call.
10 minutes, or he may have to come in and just give us his rationale. The whole point is, Jordan used to bet people when his luggage would come off the airline dolly. I mean, seriously, you really have an issue when you're betting.
Do you know what this story actually is? It's even better than
okay, give me more of it.
Not only was he betting people, but he fixed the bet. Because, he would pay the luggage handlers to take his stuff off first.
That's even worse.
So he had to cheat to win the luggage bet. Okay,
but he won it.
That is the Michael Jordan mindset in microcosm, right?
We're not saying Michael Jordan cheated in the games. I don't say that.
No, not in the games. But the point is, I'm going to do whatever is required
to
win.
Exactly. So I'm going to – the only way to settle this is – with a clip. And this clip, to me, epitomizes why Michael Jordan is the best basketball player in NBA history.
Is this from Space Jam?
Nope. No Space Jam.
Sometimes I dream that he is me. Got to see that's how I dream to be. I wanna be like Mike. If I could be like Mike.
Man, that sounded like The Lion King.
It did, but have you ever heard a song about Bill Russell or Magic Johnson?
I don't think they had Nike or Gatorade. That's Gatorade. Gatorade jingles.
That jingle, and at no point did they say the word Gatorade. I mean, the visuals right. of Gatorade, but no point did they say Gatorade. They sold that as a single in the 90s. You could buy that song as a single. Have you ever heard of another jingle created for advertising that they actually sold the song as a single?
That's a good
no.
point. That's
no
good.
LeBron. I don't want to be like LeBron. Nobody says that. Nobody has that jingle. That, to me, epitomizes. Now, LeBron wasn't even playing it when that came out. But the point is, this man had a song about him that sold millions of gallons of Gatorade. Millions of gallons.
Probably million billion gallons.
You can't even overestimate. He sold shoes. Prior to Jordan, Converse with Larry Bird, maybe Magic Johnson. No, not even close. Nike Air Jordans, by far, until today, are still coveted shoes.
They're the gold standard. I mean, so, there's guys that, you know, the rap, all these guys, they just collect.
What's LeBron's shoe again? What's he wear?
Is it the Witness?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
Exactly.
What it is.
That's
King?
The point. Nobody. Eric probably knows his
right,
shoe
sure.
size and everything.
And I'm sure it's very popular, but you're right. There's nothing on that same level.
He's not even close. An advertising juggernaut and a hugely talented basketball player. I don't know how you can separate the two because they are one and the same. The quoting being, I don't, you know, Republicans buy shoes too. That comes to Michael because he was that. He was that in a bag of chips, as some kids like
to say. So to sum up, because, yeah, I'm sure Eric has cranial shards all over his room listening to this. Probably more to you.
Probably more to me. That's fine.
LeBron is an all-time great. He belongs in the conversation, in my view, of the top five players who have ever lived. And he has the ability to surpass additional people. I know Chad says he's never going to dislodge Jabbar, and I actually think that's a defensible argument, honestly. Jabbar is very, very underrated in terms of his unstoppable
didn't have the titles.
Shot.
Didn't have
no,
all
he
the
actually
titles.
Did have the titles.
We had some titles, but he didn't have as many
he's
as
got
Russell.
Five, right?
I'm like Russell.
Okay, but he's got more than LeBron.
More than LeBron.
More MVPs, just an incredibly dominant player. He will never surpass Jordan. It doesn't matter if he plays through, you know, cryogenic freezing until he's 60 years old and goes to the finals 18 consecutive times from the Eastern Conference and then loses.
Yep.
He's just not going to get there. And that's fine.
It's okay.
That should be fine.
It's okay.
There's only ever going to be one guy that was that good.
There only ever can be.
Yeah.
Greatest of all time is a one-person slot. There is no other.
So that was a far too long tutorial, but unfortunately it is necessary because people have amnesia or people actually don't even remember what Jordan was like. So it's important that we remind people that the GOAT is always going to be from Chicago. That's just the way it is. And
he's actually from North Carolina, but he played in Chicago. Just so we
for his pro career, for purpose of his pro career, he's from Chicago, right?
Yes.
He's not winning
any awards on his
he's a Tar Heel
on
too.
His ownership of the Bobcats, but okay.
No, that's true. In fact, if we want to talk about poor ownership, we can have that discussion. Maybe LeBron will be a better owner when he retires.
When he owns the Cavaliers. So we'll leave with that.
That was way too long.
Sorry. We had to get it in there. Sorry, Eric. If you want to call us, you can call us. If you want to come in, let me know. Thanks for joining us. I'm Chad.
I'm Tony.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Hannah Tree production.